Chapter 103. Must Fall. The French Revolution. France. There Rome ruled supreme, and whosoever did not agree with the Roman Catholic Church, oh, Rome was soon done with those people. Return to Rome, or unto death. Streams of blood had already been shed in France. Just think of the terrible persecutions of the Waldenses. Just think of the Huguenots. How horrible have they been persecuted? Have we forgotten the St. Bartholomew night? Do you still remember how Louis XIV had raged against them? They were hunted as wild animals. Anything was allowed against the Huguenots. But they did not consider that a God dwells in heaven, who had observed all those atrocities, and who would take vengeance upon that innocent blood of his people. In their foolishness, they even thought they rendered a service to God thereby. What a fatal mistake! The hour of God's vengeance was fast approaching. Voltaire, Rousseau, and others had sown the seed of revolution. The dissatisfaction increased in the hearts of the poor, exhausted people. They had not the least influence in the government. The only thing which they were permitted to do was to pay taxes, and to pay some more taxes, far too much. The king and the rich and the church officials knew how to spend it. The dissatisfaction became hatred. But it seemed as if the king and his courtiers, it seemed as if the Roman Catholic clergy were blind. That could not go on that way, could it? No, neither did it go on that way. The eruption came. Finally, the long pent-up rage of the people cooled itself in the blood of tens of thousands of guilty and not guilty ones. The outbreak began in the year 1789. Then the French Revolution began. It became restless in Paris, yea, in entire France. The storm arose. Resistance came everywhere, dangerous resistance. For a time it seemed as if the king, Louis XVI, woke up. For a time it seemed as if the king wanted to bring about some changes in the unbearable state of affairs. He called the States General together, and it was decided that henceforth the common people would also have a voice in the government. The king would no longer rule alone, but a constitution would be set up to which the king himself must hold, and the people would be allowed to make their wishes known. The common people were glad already. They thought, now it is going in the right direction. Now an end shall come to our misery, to our oppression. If the king had only kept his promise, perhaps then much could have been made right, which was now wrong. But when it came to it, then the king and the French nobility were at a loss to know what they really should do. They had ruled alone so long already that they really could not concede it, that the common people would rule with them. When the third class, that means the common people, noticed that the given promise was not fulfilled, they became angry. What? Shall it now become just like it was before? Shall nothing come of all those nice promises which the king had made? That never. They met together and swore an oath that they would not disperse until France had a constitution. In the meantime, a revolt burst loose in Paris. In that city stood a large prison called the Bastilla. How much misery had already been suffered therein! How many had already sighed in those dark, musty cells of that terrible prison and had perished miserably! The people of Paris stormed that prison in mad rage. "Away with that thing!" they shouted and cried, and that gloomy building was made level with the ground. The farmers in the French countryside revolted also. In large groups they marched to the monasteries and castles and destroyed them. In the evening the sky was red of the fires. But was nothing done by the king to oppose that? Was not the army sent out against those mutinous farmers? The army? That could no longer be trusted. Numerous soldiers deserted to the embittered farmers. Instead of fighting and defeating those bloodthirsty farmers, they helped them. Yea, worse, the civilian population themselves raised an army. That army was called the National Guard. Thus, now there were two armies in France. What a confusion! Thousands of rich and prominent French people no longer dared to remain in France. They fled abroad because they feared that today or tomorrow the popular fury would turn itself against them. Thus, several years passed by. Because the harvest did not fail and the winters were not so severe, no new insurrection of the farmers followed. In 1791, the promised constitution was ready. Naturally, we are not going to tell all that was in that constitution. I shall discuss one important article. In the course of years, the Roman Catholic Church had become very wealthy. Many monasteries had extensive landed estates, and treasures of gold and other valuables were kept in the Roman Catholic Church buildings. Well then, all those church properties, all those possessions of the Roman Catholic Church were taken away from the church and became the property of the state. What a terrible defeat for the Roman Catholic Church! The monasteries were abolished, and the priests became public servants. They had to swear upon the Constitution. That means they had to promise that they would no longer obey the commands of the Pope, but that they would do everything that was written in the Constitution. When the Pope heard that, he forbade the priests to take that oath. By this, it became very difficult for the priests to make a decision. On the one hand, the danger threatened that they would become involved in difficulties with the state, and on the other hand, they feared the wrath of the Roman Catholic Prince of the Church, who perhaps would excommunicate them if they were disobedient to his express command. Only one-third of the priests took the oath, but two-thirds refused to take that oath. As I just told you, it had been fairly calm for several years, but now the unrest began all over again. The third class, which at first had nothing at all to say in the government, now wanted to play the boss alone. It became continually worse. The king was compelled to constantly sign new laws, by which the third class obtained more and more power and influence. If he had only been an energetic, self-reliant prince who knew what he wanted and retained the leadership with a firm hand, then much good could have come. But he was a weak prince who constantly hesitated and really did not know what he should do. Only an able prince who had an open eye for the changes which took place, could have saved the day. But alas, Louis XVI lacked that completely. He often hesitated when a decision had to be made. At first, he often refused to give the third class their way. But when revolt threatened, then he would concede to their wishes. Through that, the demands of the third class became constantly greater, and they became bolder and bolder. They thought, if we keep on insisting, then we shall still get our way. Through that, the conditions in France became more and more confused and dangerous. Finally, it became so bad that the king no longer knew what to do, and he fled. In all quietness, he and his wife, Marie Antoinette, and his family left Paris. Marie Antoinette was an Austrian princess. However, he was discovered outside of Paris, and then he was compelled to return to the capital of the country. The people became more and more rebellious. The royal palace was stormed, and the king became a prisoner of the revolutionary government. Louis XVI did not have it so easy. That which his predecessors had spoiled, he had to try to get back in order again, but he lacked the wisdom for that. The rage of the people did not only turn itself against the royal family, but also against the Roman Catholic Church. Revolts broke out throughout the entire country. Thousands of priests were murdered. More than 2,000 churches were destroyed and made level with the ground. The rich and the prominent also had to suffer. Thousands of nobles and other prominent persons were killed. Blood flowed in streams. They had invented a new murdering instrument in France, the guillotine. That was a weighted blade. That weighted blade was drawn up and then all at once let go. That blade whizzed down by its own weight. The wretched victims were beheaded with one blow. With wagons full of the condemned were taken to the scaffold. Especially the priests and rectors had to suffer. The people called them mockingly the Black Beast. Tribunals were set up throughout the entire country. More than 40,000 of those revolutionary tribunals came into existence. Everyone that did not agree with the revolution was dragged before those tribunals, and the usual sentence was death. Day and night, the guillotine whizzed down. No one was sure of his life for one moment. Envy, hatred, and jealousy reigned supreme. No one could be trusted. Neighbors, who for years and years had lived in peace next to each other, now informed against each other. France had become one big murder den. The powers of hell had broken loose in France. Almost 1 million people were killed. How many innocent people were amongst them? Do we not behold the avenging hand of the Lord in this? Moreover, the men of the revolution murdered each other also. Whosoever was in the government today and had hundreds of victims killed was himself beheaded the next day upon the guillotine. Everyone wanted to be boss. What an indescribable misery. Terrible. In 1793, the king was beheaded upon the scaffold. His wife, Marie Antoinette, was beheaded by the guillotine. Priests, monks, nobles with their wives and children were beheaded. The slogan of the revolution was that liberty equality, and fraternity must rule in France. Why should one person be very rich and the other as poor as can be? Nothing of that. That belonged to the past. For that reason, they had to be exterminated and murdered. Why should one live in a beautiful castle and the other in a hovel? Nothing of the kind. Away with those castles. They were leveled with the ground. Why should a church steeple tower high above the other houses? Nothing of that. Down with that thing. Thus we could go on. They made money of that stolen gold and silver. Cannons were made of the bells out of the steeples to crush with cannonballs everyone that did not agree with the principles of the revolution. Bullets were poured from the tin to settle accounts with the enemies of the republic. This terrible period is known in history as the Reign of Terror. Yea, exactly, Reign of Terror. No one was sure of his life. Who today thought that he was not in danger was taken to the scaffold tomorrow. Yea, but did they not consider that God saw all this? Did they not then fear that God would punish all this? God? He did not exist. They laughed about that in France. That was an invention of the priests. There is but one God, the people. The Christian religion? Away with that. The Christian religion was abolished. The Christian era? Away with that. No Christian era existed. They commenced anew with the year. One. That was the year of the French Revolution. That was the year of liberty. The Christian day of rest, Sunday, away with that. Every year, 36 feast days came, one every 10 days. The churches, which had not yet been destroyed, were closed. The people had been deceived long enough. They no longer believed in that. And not only that they no longer believed in it, they began to mock about everything which they had formerly considered as sacred. Let us take a look in Paris. The people stand crowded in rows along the streets. There is laughter and talking. Suddenly it becomes somewhat quieter and all eyes are turned in one direction. A strange procession draws near, for which all these people have been craning their necks to see. Men and women, seated upon donkeys, ride stately through the streets. Stately? Just look once. They are dressed in clerical garbs, which they have stolen out of the churches. They hold a communion cup in the one hand, and in the other a chalice which contains the host. According to the Roman Catholic doctrine, is not the host a wafer upon which the priest has pronounced his blessing and which thereby has been changed into the real body of Christ? Some men and women are drunk and can only remain upon their mount with the greatest difficulty. The hundreds of spectators shout and cry out. From time to time, someone rolls out of the saddle and falls heavily to the street. Then there is an outburst of laughter. It is no surprise that many are drunk, because that strange procession stops at every tavern. Then the communion cups are filled and emptied one after another. Then the procession proceeds again, till they reach another tavern, where a halt is made again and the same scene is repeated to the great amusement of the spectators. These donkey processions were nothing else than the grossest mockery. What a loathsome sight! Similar processions could be seen daily in the streets of France's capital. France had no God and no religion anymore. Yea, but nothing at all is so empty. The people had to have something, did they not? That was also taken care of. One day we see another procession draw near in the streets of Paris. Again such a donkey procession? No, not this time. Listen, cheering resounds against the front of the houses. The people leap and dance and shout for joy. Everywhere we hear the cry, "There she goes! There she goes!" Who then is going there? France's new goddess, the goddess of reason. A singer and stage actress from the theater, a certain Madame Candille, has been placed upon a float. A beautiful sky-blue cloak covers her shoulders. A crown of oak leaves adorns her head. She holds a javelin, the token of her dignity, in her hand. Thus she is triumphantly led through the streets and is cheered by the crowd. The procession draws near to the assembly room of the French government. A beautiful sedan chair stands ready. Stately she sits down on that seat. Then a few strong young men carry her into the room. All those present arise. It becomes dead silent. They put her down right by the chairman. The chairman makes a speech. He bids the new goddess a hearty welcome. On behalf of the people, he gives her a welcome kiss. The people are elated with joy. They shout. They rejoice and leap and dance. Then Madame Candille with sedan chair and all is lifted up and carried out of the room. The procession proceeds further. A beautiful Roman Catholic church, a cathedral, is located in Paris. The name of that colossal building is Notre Dame. It is the cathedral of the French capital. Well then, the procession sets out for that church. Many members of the government walk along with that procession. There she is carried inside that building. They put her throne down upon the place where formerly the high altar stood. The people fall down before her in adoration. What a loathsome sight! It seems as if the people are gone mad. Truly, that which apostatizes from the high God must fall. What becomes of a person when he has been delivered over to himself? This we see here. It was not long before France obtained many of those goddesses. Many cities imitated the example of France and chose also their goddess. Long tables were set up in some churches upon which wine and food were set out. Everyone was at liberty to help himself. It happened at times that even children staggered away drunk amid the loud laughter of those that were present. But enough of this. We shall not enlarge further upon this, because it already is bad enough. That madness did not last long. One of the fiercest revolutionary leaders was Robespierre. He was a monster who drove thousands of his fellow men into death. Yet this Robespierre abolished the religion of reason. He commanded that the French people must again believe in a supreme being and the immortality of the soul. But the shedding of blood continued. Finally, Robespierre himself had to climb the scaffold. His head also fell under the guillotine. The reign of terror terminated with his fall. To be brief, finally, Napoleon began to rule. Napoleon the tyrant, the man who offered up thousands of people to his unrestrained ambition. It happened with the French people, the same as at one time with the people of Israel. We know that from the Bible history, do we not? They constantly revolted against Nebuchadnezzar, the powerful prince of Babylon. As a visible sign of subjection at the command of the Lord, the prophet Jeremiah had to carry a wooden yoke upon his shoulders through the streets of Jerusalem. The false prophet Hananiah snatched the wooden yoke from Jeremiah's shoulders and broke it. But after that, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, "Make yourself an iron yoke." Since they did not want to bear that wooden yoke, they received an iron yoke in its place. Well then, thus it went also with the foolish French people. They had beheaded their lawful prince with the guillotine, but they received a Napoleon in his place. Napoleon was a greatly gifted man. He had received a special bright mind from the Lord. However, he misused his gifts. He did not aim at God's honor, but his own honor. He led the French armies from one victory to another. His soldiers cheered him, but the hundreds of thousands dead ones could no longer cheer him. They were laid in mass graves. One country after another was conquered by him. Almost all of Europe groaned under the iron fist of the oppressor. It seemed as if Napoleon was invincible. God used Napoleon as a scourge to punish the nations of Europe. However, he himself was not aware that he was only an instrument in the hand of the Lord. His pride knew no bounds. He has tried to hitch the Roman Catholic Church before his wagon. With this we mean that the Roman Catholic Church must also become his servant. The French people were, for the greatest part, still Roman Catholic. Well then, thus spoke Napoleon, then the Roman Catholic religion must again become the religion of the French people. But in the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope was the man who domineered over everything. Well then, said Napoleon, the Pope may quietly remain the head of the Roman Catholic Church as long as he does my bidding, as long as he approves of my laws. The Pope had to assist and support him in everything. He only wanted to use the Pope to increase his honor and glory. He made the proposal to the Pope to no longer remain in Rome, but to establish his headquarters in Paris. He, Napoleon, and the Pope must work together. He, Napoleon, would see to it that the entire world would become Roman Catholic again. The Pope would receive a beautiful guard of honor. The revenues of the Pope would be doubled. The Pope and Napoleon would honestly share all the honor and glory with each other. But whatever Napoleon tried, the Pope continued to refuse. Whatever nice promises the French conqueror made to the Pope, he refused to become the servant of Napoleon. Yea, the Pope even chose the side of France's enemies. Napoleon became furious when he saw that all his attempts failed. He had Pope Pius VI apprehended and brought to France. There Pius VI died, hence in captivity. Napoleon concluded an alliance with the new Pope, Pius VII. In 1804, the Pope traveled to Paris to crown Napoleon as emperor. The large Notre Dame was filled to capacity with members of the government and officers of the army. Solemnly, the Pope anoints Napoleon as emperor. Then he takes the valuable imperial crown and shall press that upon Napoleon's head. It is dead silent in the large church. The many who are present look on breathlessly. It is an unforgettable moment. However, suddenly Napoleon takes the crown out of the hands of the dumbfounded Pope, who naturally was not prepared for that, and he himself puts the crown upon his head. The meaning is clear, is it not? Napoleon did not want to be inferior to the Pope. The Pope was only allowed to be his inferior and must do what he desired. Finally, it nevertheless came to a clash between Napoleon and the Pope. He also had Pope Pius VII made prisoner and had him locked up near Paris. We could tell much more about that, but we shall not do so. We only told you the former to show you that through all the abominations of man, God's government nevertheless continues. God uses men, wicked men, to obtain his object. When Napoleon had served God's counsel, then God humbled him most deeply. His pride received an irrecoverable blow in the Russian snowfields. No, he was not killed at the zenith of his own power, honor, and glory. That too could have happened, and then, showered with glory, he would have descended into the grave. That honor was not awarded to him. He was humbled by the powerful hand of God. He was humbled to the greatest depth. How the word of Scripture is also fulfilled here. God resisteth the proud. Only the humble shall be exalted by the Most High God. Napoleon was not one of those humble ones. As an exile, as a broken man after body and soul, after a painful suffering, he finally died upon the small island of St. Helena in the mid-Atlantic Ocean. We may surely shudder when we consider that which awaits him in the great day of judgment. The revolution did not return to France after his death. The old kingship was restored again. A grandson of Louis XVI, who lost his life upon the scaffold, ascended the throne of his forefathers. Europe breathed again. Europe could again gradually recover itself from the prolonged and bloody wars which had been waged. But the revolutionary spirit had not disappeared with Napoleon. Alas, no, that spirit was active for a long time after that.